Hello everyone, and welcome to the 7th episode of the mini-series History Primers. Here we share some insights to introduce the various subfields and areas of history. So far, we have covered political, intellectual, social, cultural, economic, and global history. By now, you may well be aware of the wide and encompassing dimensions that researches in history could take. In this episode, we will focus on another important field, that which is very close to podcasts, as we ourselves practice this field through this show. Today, we talk about public history. What I will share today are notes from a paper I wrote back when I was still studying in UP. I am Aaron Maliari, and this is Podcast, Conversations in Philippine History, Politics, and Society. In November 2016, a few months after Rodrigo Duterte ascended to the Philippine presidency, the nation was shaken when former Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos was interred at the Libingan ng mga Bayani. Shaken in the sense that the Filipino people had to again confront competing memories of a critical period in their past, that of martial law. Heated debates sparked anew, conjuring opposing perspectives about the late president's legacy, the context of martial law, questions of interpreting the legality of his burial at the Libingan ng mga Bayani, and notions of moving on and letting time heal. Plunged at the heart of this emotion-filled conundrum was the nation's history and how it ought to be reckoned. Taken in a challenging position were the country's historians, who themselves may have differing views of the issues at hand. When the late president was inevitably transferred to the Libingan ng mga Bayani, Maria Serena Diokno, the then chair of the National Historical Commission, resigned and released a statement, lamenting, and I quote, "At this moment in our history, every voice counts, and I wish to place mine on the side of history. Not the history that the Duterte government ignores, but the history that beckons our people to demand justice." End quote. While many historians made their position clear, perplexing were the statements of the people that reacted to such statements. In many ways, we saw here bearing into light the common adage, "There is only one past, but many histories." Diokno's statement also underscored an interesting point. She mentioned that, and I quote, "The multitude of especially young Filipinos who have come out in defense of history and are prepared to co-author it for their generation in the future point to a clear realization. They, we all, will guard our history." End quote. It thus brings in the question, who can and how do we ought to talk about the past? These 2016 events can serve as an exemplary episode on how history, as a field of knowledge, crosses the borders of academia and comes into contact with the public, influencing social action, questioning government policy, and ultimately revealing itself as an embattled terrain. How then do we come to terms with such a dilemma? When conversations about history reverberate outside the confines of academia, the debates become more grounded on the way historical knowledge is produced, disseminated, and consumed, bringing into the conversation not just those traditionally trained in the field of history, but all others that could lay claim to the past. Some historians that engage in applying their training outside academia are often regarded as public historians. But what is public history? If we are to begin understanding what public history is, we cannot disengage it from the conventional idea of history as that practiced in the academe, since the very history of public history is inextricably bound within the broader historiography of history itself. It was in the context of the 19th to the early 20th centuries when history as an intellectual pursuit in the West began to take hold as a discipline. Those engaged in the endeavor of making sense of the past started recognizing that to be regarded as a historian, one needs training and eventually possess advanced degrees. As history was formally taught in universities and degrees in it were conferred, the methods and theories of history began developing. By the mid-20th century, however, there became an observable decline in the interest in history when, as Leflaire and Brandt noted, students found the standard interpretation of the past quite at variance with their own experience and often demeaning to it. The view about history as an academic pursuit would find sustained obstacles when what has been referred to as the job crises in the field of history became apparent, with graduates of the discipline having a difficult time securing employment. One cited reason was the idea that the formal training in history had its graduates best prepared to work as academics in universities. As graduates of history started to sojourn outside academia in the late 60s and 50s, the crises prompted historians in the universities to confront the challenge of finding ways to prepare history graduates for work outside the academe. Hence, public history in the United States would trace its formal beginnings in the 1970s, when the first academic programs geared towards producing graduates ready to engage in work outside the university setting were set up. As formal degree programs in public history were introduced, a new challenge would confront historians as the bifurcation of categories between who is an academic and public historian began brewing tensions. As William Rubinstein pointed out, beyond the type of history practiced and engaged in by university academics, there is a vast other world of amateur, antiquarian, popular, and public historians who are almost invariably ignored by university historians, just as these outsiders ignore the academics. However, as academic historians could haphazardly deploy the categories amateur or dabblers to describe individuals engaging in historical work without prior training in history, one major challenge that academic historians that started the public history movement had to face was the handling of courses on public history. While this could be addressed with interdisciplinary teaching modules or field exposure, there was still high probability that those handling public history courses had no prior experience in it. Hence, as an academic historian could lament about a non-trained individual engaging in history, the same criticism could be laid before him. He had no training in public history. Moreover, as the paths of the two worlds eventually intertwined with the establishment of the formal public history programs, pertinent issues about turfs, audience, authority, and approaches surfaced. As a subfield of history, one of the key elements that scholars of public history needed to grapple with involved the boundaries, scope, or in simpler terms, the definition of what counts as public history. The efforts inevitably involved reflections about the difference between academic and public history. Considered as one of the fathers of public history, Robert Kelly offered a starting point. He mentioned that the significant question in discriminating between the kind of history we have been accustomed to and that of public history is the following. Who is posing the question to which the historian is seeking to give an answer? Kelly distinguished that in academic history, the questions about the past is posed by historians themselves, meaning the historian is doing research based on his interests, answering questions he posed, and looking for sources to answer those questions. While in public history, questions are posed by others. As public historians aim to serve at the behest of the public, they also began clarifying that there is a difference between them and those that do not necessarily possess training in history. This is a point of agreement between academic and public historians. As public historians aim to effectively tackle the challenges of questions posed by others, they needed to be equipped with the tools of the historian. As such, the public and academic historian's journey both begin in the university. As the public history movement gained ground, the curricula and professional organizations that developed to support the new field intended to ground the training of practitioners or professional historians to respond to the interests and work toward the work of their audience, rather than simply to please themselves in the topics they choose to study, in the timetables and deadlines under which they conduct their work. With this collaborative nature of public history, it has been underscored that public history is collective history, such that it is both collaborative with other disciplines, and knowledge production involves a two-way process between the historian and the audience. And in many ways, it is also popular history, in that it is consumed by a mass audience. With the vision of being engaged with the public, one clarification that the literature on public history has dealt with involved the very notion of the public in public history, and the interplay between this public and the historian in terms of co-authoring history. Scholars of public history also have several notions of this public as consumers and collaborators of history. There are iterations of having macro audience to denote the general public, as opposed to a micro audience to mean, for example, students in university. Another view involved the dichotomy between public and private, invoking Habermasian notions of the public sphere. For the purposes of this discussion, we could pertain to the public in the context of public history as the members of a community with whom a historian works with as sources of data, as collaborators, or as the audience. Thus, public history also undoubtedly holds an optimistic view of society's willingness to engage questions about the past. Ronald Greel aptly summed it when he remarked that as public history brought some modifications to the role of the historian, it also holds a democratic declaration of faith in members of the public at large to become their own historians and advance their own knowledge of themselves. Well, this is not entirely a new idea, because in 1932, Carl Becker already forwarded the notion of everyone being his own historian. Since the effort of public history also greatly revolves around the involvement of the public, it is important to also note that the public is not entirely naive about history. Doing public history, therefore, brings to light the needed realization on the part of the historian that authority needs to be shared. By sharing, it needs to be emphasized that the historian need not surrender the role of lending the interpretive language that would make the past comprehensible, as well as the rigorous testing of reliability and credibility. It rather implies the idea that ownership of the past and authority to speak about it is not confined to the world of academics. Since agency is exercised, there are questions of willingness to share authority, opening up the need for negotiations. Public historians, therefore, could also be seen as mediators between the past and the present, between the truths we want to tell and the truths people want to tell us. As such, doing public history involves a methodology that also necessitates techniques to nimbly navigate accounts that could be competing and even colliding with one another, especially when it begins to come into contact with the public as the intended audience. Since public history opened the doors for students trained in history to have wider career options, it also involves a multitude of approaches and modes of engagement. One of the most common lies in the field of heritage. When historians devote their careers and apply their training in heritage work, we find them in museums and other institutions that promote the dissemination of historical knowledge to the people. When you enter a museum, for example, you see galleries that are carefully thought out and curated. Every exhibition has an argument. The next time you visit a museum, I encourage you to also reflect and ask yourselves, what is this exhibit trying to tell me? Does it offer me new knowledge, affirm what I know, or does it refute what I believed in? Aside from heritage work, public historians are also found in different organizations that promote history, or maybe even in agencies like the National Historical Commission of the Philippines. They could also grant interviews in programs to lend their expertise, or they themselves host and produce these programs. They could also offer consultancy in historically inspired documentaries, movies, television shows, novels, etc. They could be writing a column in your daily broadsheet, or they could maintain a blog. Nowadays, with the advent of social media, you see them actively maintaining Facebook pages, YouTube channels, or Twitter and TikTok profiles. Some even do podcasts. If there is one thing that public history teaches us, it is that history should never be confined to the academe. In especially complicated and tense situations fraught with social and political issues, public history bridges the gap between the ivory tower of academia and the everyday lives of the people. While historians in public history offer their expert training, the public is never disconnected, since we can always underline that at the end of the day, history is a narrative, a story, our story, and we all should be concerned about it. That's it for this installment of the History Primers. This is just a short introduction to public history, but I hope it helps in shedding light about this important field of history. Thank you for listening. I am Aaron Maliari. Have a good day.